go!
And we're your hosts. I'm Diane Bortoletto.
And I'm Monique Chicardo.
Let's do it.
Hello, hello, and welcome to And Away We Go F1 podcast, a Formula One podcast that goes beyond the track limits to talk about travel, food, and lifestyle surrounding the sport. I'm Diane Bortoletto, your pre-Drive to Survive Formula One fan, and today I'm in Perth in Western Australia.
And I'm Monique Chicardo, your post-Drive to Survive fan, and today I'm sitting in my hometown of Bunbury in Western Australia.
Yay! Yay, you're still home. It's so good to have you in the same time zone. And this week, I'm so excited. We've got one of the most experienced people I've ever come across in motorsport. We've got Stuart Gunn, who has worked in motorsport for close to 60 years and in Formula One for over 40 years. He's run media centres in Abu Dhabi, Singapore, India, Austin, Mexico and other places, taking a team with him to run those media centres. That includes Annie Bradshaw, who you can listen to in episode 9, and Rob Van Leeuwen, who I used to work with at Rally Australia, part of the World Rally Championship. Welcome to the show, Stuart.
Thank you very much. It's lovely to be with you.
So, Stuart, just give us an overall, a bit of background as to how you started working in motorsport and Formula One.
Well, I need to take you back to when dinosaurs roamed the earth, because when I was a child in Scotland, the name Le Mans 24 Hours came into my compass because a Scottish team racing Jaguars, Écurie Écosse, which simply means Team Scotland, won the fabled Le Mans race in 56 and 57. And I was very aware of Écurie Écosse because just down the road from where I lived was Charterhall, old airfield converted to race circuit, and they did a lot of racing there. And almost simultaneously, in another village 6 miles from where I lived a person by the name of Jim Clark. And Jim Clark, wow. For those who don't know of him, was Scotland's greatest ever racing driver, one of the greatest ever. And he went on to win the World Championship in 63 and 65. And I was keenly aware of Jim Clark at that time. But then paths diverged and I went on and followed the educational path I was expected to and didn't go into and think about going into motorsport at all. So it wasn't until I left academic life, in which I worked to move to the BBC in 1982, that I started to work in motorsport. I moved to BBC in London, in a department called CFAX, which was Teletext. I don't know if you had it here in Australia.
It's a kind of a, right. Oh, gosh.
Some of our social media stuff here, because it was instantaneous. It had a big following. And being at the BBC, doors would open to you. You were encouraged to seek out a niche for yourself. Mine was A, sport, and B, motorsport. So Brands Hatch, close to which I lived, became my home from home. And I went on from there. Actually, just to tell you a story, if I may, talking of Brands Hatch, when I was going to my first British Grand Prix at Brands Hatch in 1982 and talking to somebody about what I should do there, he said, well, just look for a blonde lady being pursued by a posse of media blokes and ask her. And that was Annie Bradshaw. And there she was. It was exactly as he described. I arrived at Brands Hatch, looked at the media center, somebody going in the door, blonde lady, posse of media following her. Long story short, Annie Bradshaw and I have been lifelong friends. So the British Grand Prix of 1982 was the first one at which I formally worked.
Oh, fantastic. Annie was such a great guest to have on the podcast, wasn't she, Monique?
Oh my gosh. Her episode was it was so full of wonderful stories. And I mean, I anticipate this podcast will be too, given the tenure that you've had in Formula One, the stories that you're going to have.
She's a very hard act to follow. We'll do our best.
Another thing I want to ask you about, Stuart, is that, and very remiss of me not to include this in the intro, is that you've authored more than 10 books. Also an incredible achievement. They're all mostly of a sporting nature. Is that fair to say?
Yes. Some of them also, I have to point out, co-authored, but I did more of the authoring than the co in each case. So, yes, it's about 17 or 18 now, a lot of them on motorsport in general.
Fantastic.
One of the stories that you've written about that we know quite well is Mark Webber. He was an Australian, am I correct in saying world champion? He was definitely a Formula One driver.
He's in Finland, came very close in 2010, but just didn't quite get it across the line.
Yeah.
I worked closely with Mark on two books, actually. Yeah.
Fantastic. Oh, my gosh.
What's the process when you're writing a book about someone like that? How many hours are you sitting with them and interviewing them, or do you do a section at a time? How do you go through the process of writing a book about someone like Mark Webber?
The Australian Grand Prix, which I hadn't worked for 30-odd years, must have been 2009, I think. The beginning of 2010, Mark and I knew each other. I knew him from his days of coming over to Britain to race. And somebody suggested to them that if he was keen on doing a book, he should maybe have a wee chat with me, aforementioned chat. And we were going to do a book on the 2010 season because Mark was then in his heyday with Red Bull and looked like a chance, even though a certain Sebastian Vettel was the darling boy at Red Bull. So I said yes, and then long story short again, that book turned into a story of the 2010 season, as it were, and the ultimate disappointment for Mark in Abu Dhabi, where I was present when he missed out on the title. But then the publisher asked me if I would consider doing Mark's biography with him. And that process took a couple of years, I suppose, 2.5 years. And to answer your original question, it depends on the subject. Some people are very helpful, some are not. So you've got to make sure that A, that you know your stuff about the subject, and B, that they know that you know that. And I remember going to Mark's beautiful home in England, the Rookery, when we were first starting out, and I took out a couple of notebooks. And he said, "What's that?" And I said, "That's a record of every single race you've ever competed in, where you started, where you finished, what happened to you, etc." And I don't know why he seemed to be and blown away by that, as if he didn't expect me to make that sort of preparation. So that's what you have to do. You have to know your stuff, and you have to be able to speak to the person, not as an equal, obviously, because he or she is doing something you can, but at least as somebody who knows what they've been through. And the process is fairly straightforward. You inform yourself and work out what sort of questions need to be answered. You think of the audience that you're writing for and what they might like to hear, and then you work together from there, and quickly you work up a rhythm, as it were, which is very difficult, of course, when a man's halfway around the world at any given time of the year, getting in and out of a racing car and so on. But he was very, very generous with his time, and fortunately, I was in a lot of the places where he was racing, so he could do bits and pieces there. But most of that book was done at his lovely home in Buckinghamshire in England. I guess it took the better part of a year and a half, because while we were working on it, he took the decision that he would quit Formula One, but was going to race sports cars, and he was going to race at Le Mans and so on. So we thought, okay, let's wait until you've done that, and we'll take it from there. So it was a long process. It was quite an arduous one, because he and Anne, his now wife, are very demanding people, as you have to be as successful as they've been. But I think it came through the test. It was a great process. Mark Webber, as you'll discover later, is one of my all-time F1 heroes.
Oh, I love hearing that. That's so beautiful.
Yeah, it's great, isn't it?
I have a question about the book writing process. If you're sitting there for 2 years, you've got a wealth of knowledge and a wealth of information to share. How do you then edit that down to just a book? You know, coming from my travel writing background, sometimes it's so hard to filter out.
The hardest thing, edit, you say. If you find an editor at the publishing company who is in sympathy with the subject and with you, that makes life a lot easier. A lot of the time, because F1 motor racing general is so specialized, the sub-editors or editors are not quite in tune, and that makes it a wee bit harder, but they do help to sort of nudge the ship into harbor, you know? But it's just... Sure. When you've worked as long as I have in a particular area, you know what it is that's the crux of what's going on. You know what the bones of it are. And then you can, so you have to have those. And then when it's necessary or when it's possible, you flesh them out with anecdote or whatever. So that's the way I've always approached. You must try, especially if it's a biography, you must try to respect the voice of the person whom you are trying to represent. And Mark has a very authentic voice, a very Australian voice, not just in accent, but in whole demeanor and life experience. We were on kind of the same wavelength, different accents, same wavelength.
Speaking of Australia, what brought you to Australia, Stuart? You know, we can detect an accent there. So where are you from, and how did you end up in the Mornington Peninsula?
The first thing that brought me to Australia was the 1986 Australian Grand Prix, at that stage, I was in the final throes of writing my first BBC Grand Prix book, and the BBC kindly coughed up enough money for me to attend a few races, including the last one of the season in wonderful Adelaide. So that was my first experience of Australia, which was a jaw-dropping thing because, you know, I've traveled a lot, but I've never been this far. And I got off the plane in those days in Sydney, because you couldn't fly direct to Adelaide, and then the hop to Adelaide. And first of all, I was sitting beside English team manager Ken Tyrrell on the plane on the way down. And Ken nudged me as we came over Adelaide, and he said, "Most beautiful cricket ground in the world," which was the Adelaide Oval. And then when he got to Adelaide, I looked at the sky and thought, I've never seen a sky like this. You know, the quality of the light in South Australia, just magic. Must have been something like the Impressionist painters wanted to find when they went to the Mediterranean. And it was just glorious, and I loved it. And it was terrific. I mean, I was working with the Tyrrell team, but Mike Drewer, who was then responsible for the media center, kindly asked me to help out because I have languages in my background, so I could build bridges to the international media for Mike. And then they kindly kept asking me back. But the second answer to your question is, you always, as the French say, chef de la femme. In the late 1980s, I had met the lady who was going to be my second wife, Claire, in London, where we were both working. And at one point she said to me, "I don't suppose you consider going and living in Australia?" And I said, "When do we leave?" So that was it. And we came to Australia end of 89 for Grand Prix, and then returned at the beginning of 90 to live permanently in Australia.
Yeah. Oh, so you moved to Australia for love. How nice. Yeah.
It's just like me moving to Norway for love.
Exactly.
I won't tell you which love was greater, motorsport or the women involved.
You're going to get in trouble, Stuart.
I love that.
Fantastic. And you mentioned Ken Tyrrell, and you've worked with Ken Tyrrell as well. Can you tell us a bit about that?
I had been in comfortable little academic life for a while and thought this was not nearly enough. I mean, who wants to get the same lectures for 40 years, you know? So I thought, I must try something else. I had a brief flirtation with cancer as well. I thought to myself, well, that's a wee sign you should do other things, you know, just in case. So I did a very un-Scottish thing and took a drop in salary to go and join the BBC at London. And after a certain time at the BBC, as things were then back in the 80s, I got a phone call one, I don't know what it was, beginning of a week. Would I come and have lunch? Went to have lunch, and then on the following Friday, I was in Brazil with the Tyrrell team. They're working on my first Grand Prix as press officer with the team. I had been working with Annie Bradshaw in a company called CSS in London, which was responsible for sponsorship and driver seeking and so on for a number of teams and sponsors, and brought the two together. And they asked me to go because they had Ken Tyrrell's team on their books for 1986, and they wanted somebody with languages who could sort of build bridges, as I said, to the international media, because Ken spoke beautiful English, but nothing else. And they were keen to escape the old Uncle Ken, very English image. And that was my first year with them, which was wonderful. Ken was great. And my drivers were Martin Brundle, the famous Colin and Philippe Stress. I think the team used to call them Brundle and Stress, Trouble and Strife. That's great.
Oh, wow. Fabulous. So what languages do you speak, Stuart?
My first degree was in French and German, so I speak reasonable enough German. We had to specialize in one or the other, so one would always suffer. And I did honors French and lived in France and so on. So my French is near native, which is just because I've been there so long, so many times. German's good. I can get by perfectly well in Italian and Spanish. And sometimes when I go to other places, I try and pick up the rudiments, you know, like going on holiday in Greece or something. It's always nicer if you can speak to people in their own language, even if just to say please and thank you.
Yeah, we're both travel writers.
Yeah, well, you understand exactly what I mean. Yes. Exactly.
And you know the basics, right? When you know so many languages, it makes it easier to understand a whole lot of other languages.
By and large, one follows the other. And, you know, you have an ear for things, but you don't have an ear. And I seem to have a bit of an ear for it without plumo and trumpet. It's always been a major part of my language, speaking foreign languages.
Yeah, it's so nice being able to speak. I speak Italian, not as perfectly as I would like. And I took myself off to university, study Italian for 4 years because I wanted to learn to read and write and speak properly. And I did learn all those things. And then COVID hit, right? So I had 3 years of not being able to go to Italy and put it all to practice.
And of course, it gives you a different perspective on things too. If you can at least with half your brain think on the way. A French journalist asking you a question about something, you might have an idea of where he's coming from with the question and so on. So it always helps. Always helps. Just an anecdote that helps with that is that the early 90s, Ayrton Senna had a long battle with teammate Alain Prost. And of course, things had gone wrong in Japan with accidents, etc., etc. And the British media had antagonized Ayrton to a certain extent. Ayrton was the most civilized and gentlemanly of persons. But coming to Adelaide in 1993, he declared that he would not have any press conferences in English, but he would hold a press conference with the French media. Lucky me, I was asked to go along and interpret for anybody that didn't manage to make the gap between what Ayrton was saying and what the French journalists were asking. And it was just fantastic. He was under pressure, you could tell. He was strained. But he answered every question as polite as possible. And he was sitting like, I am now in front of you. And every time he hesitated and looked at me and I explained to him or gave him the English or French word for things, he said, thank you.
Oh.
After the conference, it was just, he was an absolute gentleman. So, and it was just the fact of the languages that had got me into that privileged position.
Ayrton was answering the French press in French? And he was
no, he's answering them in English by and large. But sometimes if he hadn't quite understood what one of the questions was, I helped him with that. And if then they didn't understand what Ayrton had said, I translated it into French.
Oh. Yes, yeah.
I wonder, Stuart, have you watched the Ayrton Senna documentary or the new Netflix series that's just come out about Ayrton Senna?
I haven't seen the Netflix yet. The Ayrton Senna documentary, yes.
Yeah. And was it accurately portrayed? I mean, you knew him and were working around that era in Formula One.
I think so, yes. I thought it was very, very well done. I'll tell you a funny story about that as well. When it came out, we were in Melbourne working at the Grand Prix and we were invited to a preview screening of the Ayrton Senna documentary. And for some reason, they had a glitch with their recording on the audio side of things. So we didn't get the English version. We got the Portuguese or the Brazilian, which is Portuguese version. Happily, people like me who knew what was going on, you could relate to what was being said and so on and so forth. And there were no subtitles. Before premiere, they had an advert for Johnny Walker Scotch Whiskey. And they put subtitles on the Scottish actor who was speaking the dialogue for the advert. I was outraged. It was Robert Carlyle, who's since gone on to very great things in film and TV.
It's funny.
Oh, incandescent.
That's brilliant.
Anyway. Yeah. Incandescent.
Oh, well, it's a Scottish accent. Come on, it's not that hard.
Well, you know exactly. I mean, you can understand me perfectly well, can't you?
Absolutely. We can. Yeah.
I want to listen to you talk all day. I love the Scottish accent. It's one of my favourite accents in the world.
You soon get very tired of that.
Trust me, the two times I've been to Scotland, honestly, could sit there and talk to people all day because of the accent. So I don't understand the need for subtitles. That was very rude. I actually had a question to go back to, you know, you said you've worked with Annie Bradshaw and you've had such a wonderful career in motorsports and Formula One. And we spoke to Annie just about the change that she's, you know, do you have any comments on that? What it's been like from when you first started working in motorsports and Formula One to what you see now with the media, the Netflix effect, all that sort of thing?
Oh, well, it's night and day, isn't it? Really, like most things in life now because of social media and the accessibility of everything. I mean, back when I was starting, you know, there was no such thing as a portable typewriter, hardly. It was a joy when we could stop cutting telex tapes. And Canon, I think it was, came out with a self-correcting typewriter. So you didn't have to have wee bits of paper that you put in and so on. That was great until one of those I eventually threw in the bin because I got so angry with it. But never mind. So we had that. And then, of course, we went on to taxes and then internet and stuff like that. It's amazing how things have developed. I think it's a double-edged sword. I think there is such accessibility to all sport in particular, and now to F1. People are instant experts, you know, so there's an increasingly large divide, I think, in people of a certain age like myself and people of a certain age like the present generation and yourselves who are forging careers for yourselves. But it can only be a good thing that information is available, as long as people take information with a pinch of salt sometimes.
Yes.
Weigh up the information, they judge the information. And as long as the information that they put out to their audience is fact-checked and as accurate as it can be, and not just made-up stories, you know, because there's a lot of stuff that goes round and round. But the worst thing anybody can do, especially somebody in at my time of life, is to think, oh, it's not as good as it was in my day, because of course it is. It was good in your day because you were there and it was great. But it's great now because you're there. It's just right. But of course, one of the things I think is regrettable is the distance between journalists and to even the lifelong journalists who are at every race and the drivers themselves, who are now so busy that there's very little time to make a relationship with the driver and work closely with him. And there are now allotted media times, and there's sometimes they're only 10 minutes. What are you going to glean in 10 minutes? So I think it must be difficult now for a person starting out to establish a position of trust between him or herself and the driver or whoever it is that he wants to talk to. But on the other hand, the audience is now so vast, and things like Netflix have brought people so much closer to what's going on behind the scenes that can only be a good thing, can't it?
Yeah.
Had lunch on Sunday with longtime friends used to work with both in Melbourne and Adelaide, and they both said they could not wait for the next series of Netflix to come out because they both loved it and they've been at the center of things, you know, and they just love it. So I think it's great. And if it increases the audience and if it brings a young audience and a diverse audience to the sport, then that's fantastic.
Like you said, the double-edged sword, it's so hard to get that quality time with the drivers and to really go so deeply into their stories. But then you have new waves of media like the Netflix series that really do take you deep behind the scenes that you never got to see before, just in a different way to what I guess it would have been, you know, in the 70s, in the 80s. So,
absolutely different, but it's not better nor worse. It's different, and it's good, different, as I say, than some supermarket chains.
The drivers are going direct to their own audience now these days as well.
Yeah,
that's the other thing. They cultivate their own following, don't they? So a lot of the work is done for people like us.
Back in the day, I remember when I first started working in motorsport in 30 odd years ago, you know, it would be having to wait for the magazine to be printed and you'd be reading the news and catching up then. And now it's not always through the third party, like it's from teams direct, from drivers direct. And I think it's only enhanced the fans now because they feel like they've got a personal relationship with the driver or the team or the personnel or whoever.
And with that goes the advance in media coverage, doesn't it? I mean, what you're doing, for example. But when you think of the in-car vision that we get now, you never got that in the old days. Mm-hmm. You know, you saw the driver going round, and that was it. When I worked with Stewart Grand Prix, Rubens Barrichello was one of my drivers. Rubens had one button on his steering wheel. Now they've got, I don't know what it is, 20, and each one of them has got about 6 or 7 different modes, and they're doing this at 300 k's an hour down the street.
I know.
It's amazing. And now the in-car footage is just phenomenal. It's fantastic. It really is. A lot has changed for the better. There's no question about that.
In today's Formula One world, the team and the media and PR teams have become, I won't say exponentially more important, but there has been a lot more pressure placed on them because so much does come direct from them to socials or something like that, as opposed to, you know, going and sitting down in a media center. I feel like there's a lot more pressure maybe on them to do the job.
Oh, 100%. When people like me were starting out, you know, when I was a press officer with Cummins, you'd put out your press report afterwards, and as Annie was saying, we'd go around and distribute a piece of paper, guys would take it away, and then somebody might give you a call after this or during the week or something, but their pieces were only going to come out a day later or 3 days later. Some of them were weekly, so their stuff wasn't coming out till the next week. It seemed frantic, but it was a much more leisurely pace. And now the pace really is frantic. And of course, one person couldn't possibly handle all of the questions that arise and all of the interest in what a driver does, what his favorite food is, what team he supports, where he was yesterday, etc. You know, you wouldn't learn about drivers celebrating victories by going and having a Big Mac and playing a game of Monopoly on the plane or something like that, as we did with Oscar Piastri. I mean, it was just, the pace was a lot, yeah, it seemed frantic, but it wasn't good that way. And nowadays, I believe it really is frantic, and you need a large team of skilled people to manage the media themselves, i.e. the mediums through which we report on F1, and to manage the people who are in the media, and to manage all the false
exactly
truth, which is coming through.
Like, if a story is published that's inaccurate and it comes out early, what a lot of websites and media outlets do is they report on what another site has reported, and if that's wrong, so you've really got to be on the front foot to quash any of those inaccuracies straight away before they start getting published on all other different websites.
Yeah,
you can't unsee lies, can you? You just can't unsee lies. So you've got to be very, very careful about which
point out there. Yeah, which then harks back to what you were saying about there being such a big landscape and people needing to be careful about what they say and making sure that they know everything and they fact check.
I think some of that has gone out of the window. A certain type of reporting these days, it's a bit cavalier, but that's only an old fellow thinking, oh, well, hang on, you can't say that, you shouldn't say that, and so on. So I think by and large, it's fantastic. There is so much coverage, right? And the diversity of it as being demonstrated by yourselves is just terrific. You know, young people can come in and they can make a career for themselves very quickly, which was not the case back then, but that's no bad thing either. People have to have opportunities, and if the sport gives it to them, let them grasp them.
Yeah. Mm. Oh, I love the positivity. It's wonderful.
It is. Shall we turn back the clock a bit and talk about your very first motorsport race that you worked on in 1967, which was during the great era of Ford versus Ferrari and that epic rivalry. How did you get your first job, Stuart?
Well, again, preamble is required. I was then in the third year of my first degree at Glasgow University, and doing double honours in languages, you had to choose one country to go to for a year and one country to go to for one semester. I chose France to go to for a year. Now, almost all my classmates wrote to the Scottish Education Department and said, can you please send me to Paris, or can I go to the Côte d'Azur? I was sent to a school as English language assistant in Le Mans, famous for the 24-hour race. That was funny too, because I actually received a letter from the person who was going to greet me at the station saying he would be standing there wearing a Macintosh with a copy of the Times rolled up under his arm, as if it was a spy movie. Because, of course, you have to remember, back then, everything was done either by a long-distance phone call or by a letter. There were no mobile phones, there was no social media, there was no internet, no email, perhaps. So anyway, I arrived in Le Mans, and happily for me, one of the first people I met was a motor racing enthusiast by the name of Paul Chabin, who was older than me, but working in the school. And the very first Sunday, and this is in September, he said, we're going to the circuit. And I said, okay, no one knows what's going on the circuit. It was a club meeting. It was pouring with rain. But we got there, and I remember walking through the famous pine trees at the northern end of the circuit and seeing the circuit unfold before me. And that was it, and I was in love. Then later, as the year went on, and going around Le Mans a bit with other schools, so I got a call to ask if I'd be interested in working at the 24 Hours. And I became the official interpreter for the French motorsport media at the 1967 Le Mans 24 Hours. So I had passes to go everywhere, do everything. And there was a time when a lot of big-name F1 drivers were in sports car racing too. And Le Mans then was still probably the greatest race on the planet. So, you know, you're rubbing shoulders with people like McLaren and Donoghue, Phil Hill, Mario Andretti. I could tell you another story about that.
Yeah, tell us.
Please do.
All those guys were all there. And, you know, I could get down and pit talk to them and rub shoulders, and it was fantastic. And I was on circuit for like 48 hours on the tour. During the 24 hours, there's an English commentator as well as a French. And as I said, he's had this terribly poor voice. He always kept saying, no, I've got the glasses on them now, and coming down the hill straight is so on, so on. You know? So this went on for 24 hours, and I had belly full of this English accent. Anyway, after the race, dead tired, out for a meal, into restaurants, flumped back in the bucket seats, the bench seats, rather, a couple of bottles of wine come out, and I just thought, I had my new beautiful French jacket on, Scottish tweed jacket tailor-made for me in the Le Mans. And I just bent forward and picked up the two bottles of wine and said, "I'm covering down the home straight." And I didn't realize the corks were out of the wine already. So, new French jacket.
Covered in red wine.
Oh. That'll teach you for taking the mickey out of someone.
They kindly asked me to go back for the 68 race, but that was not cancelled, but postponed because of all the student uprisings around Germany and France and trade union activities and huge strikes in France. So I couldn't go. I believe had I gone to that second 24-hour race, I would have gone home, finished my degree, and then gone for a job in motorsport. As it happened, I didn't, and I got back to my studies, and the academic door opened, and I went through it, only to come out of it a few years later.
Wow. And so you weren't a motorsporting family and you weren't into motorsports until you went to Le Mans?
No, not at all. No, there was no motor racing connection in the family at all. And it's just a happy coincidence for me that I got sent to Le Mans.
Yeah, and you just fell in love with it straight away.
Oh, so, I mean, imagine, you know, 7-litre Fords against 4-litre Ferraris. And naturally, you go for the Ferrari, don't you? And they were just, Jackie Stewart, the Ferrari 330 P4. Jackie Stewart himself said it was still the most beautiful car ever built. So it's not a bad judgment.
Wow. Yeah. Of course. He's held in such high esteem by everyone. So to hear that from him, you'd hold that in high esteem too.
Yes. Although there's a caveat to that as well.
Oh, there's a caveat to that. We better hear this.
Well, I mean, no disrespect, darling, but in 1996, Jackie Stewart was setting up his own Formula One team by which I was working in Melbourne. And he was there in 96. And I just said to him, "Look, if you need any help with local knowledge or anything before the team comes down, just let me know." Long story short, phone call, Stuart becomes the first media manager for Stuart Grand Prix. And I learned in the course of the year that something I had learned before, that it's best, I think, to keep your sporting idols out on the pitch or the track where they work with magic for you rather than get to know them too well.
I
mean, Jackie is kindness itself, and of course, nobody can gainsay his brilliance as a driver and so on. And I had a wonderful year with him, with Rubens Barrichello and Jan Magnussen. So for Jackie to say the 330 P4 was his most beautiful car ever, that's fine by me. At least he was right there.
You've got a first-class honours in modern languages and also a PhD. So should we be calling you Dr. Stewart?
In theory, yes, it should. That is my official title, but I never use it because it's just so pretentious, you know. But like I said, sometimes if I've got to write to the government or a lawyer or something, I use the correct definition of myself as doctor, but normally people in Australia, people call me Stewie, for goodness sake.
Stewie, yeah.
I do have the title, I do have the qualifications, but they're not a lot of importance to what I do now or have done for a long time.
Going back to Martin Brundle, who you mentioned earlier, I take it you still watch the Grand Prix when they're on television. And do you see Martin Brundle doing the grid walk and trying to interview all the various celebrities? I've got to say, besides Lights Out and the race starting, that is my favourite part of the Grand Prix coverage, is Martin Brundle's grid walk, because I just love how he tries so hard to get really good interviews and people just either idiots or they fob him off or they're busy or he can't get through the throngs of people. Was the grid that busy back in the day, or is this a new
issue? Yeah, it was always not as busy now, not as many TV crews and not as many
celebrities
doing video recordings and stuff like that, and not quite as many, shall we call them, hangers-on or distinguished guests and celebrity visitors and so on. Not quite that many. So it's a very crowded place. And Mark Webber, I can't remember who it was, which sportsman it was he invited to a race. Anyway, this chap was blown away by the fact that he was on the grid with Matt for X minutes before he clambered into the car and so on. And he was just blown away by the fact that Mark had to put in all the other drivers had to endure this noise and chaos around them when they get about ready to risk their lives and go out there and perform.
Right. Yeah.
I know all elite sports people work under immense pressure and require immense concentration, but to do what these Grand Prix drivers do is amazing.
Which, I mean, kind of makes sense when you see them with their headphones on the side of the grid with their trainer doing, you know, reaction times with their mind is kind of creating a bit of a shield. You can understand why. That absolutely. When Martin does manage to catch a professional sportsman on the grid, who, you know, be it a boxer or a footballer or cricketer or whoever, often they comment, "I can't believe that we're this close to the drivers that are about to get in the car."
Exactly right. But there you go. Those are the territory. Yeah, it's the most fantastic experience when you see the driver again, and it, suddenly everybody disappears off the grid, and it's just electric. It's absolutely electric.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, 67 Le Mans 24-hour race was the second last, I think, before they stopped the famous Le Mans start. You know, when the drivers line up opposite the car and sprint to the car and get into the vehicle. And that weekend, my first Le Mans, there were 500,000 spectators on the circuit. And all that you could hear was the driver's footsteps going across the grid as they leapt into the cars. I've never forgotten that.
Wow.
Being on a grid like that, it's just an amazing, I'm the hair standing up on the back of my neck right now.
That's amazing to have that many people around at a motorsport event. 500,000 people, did you say, and dead silence that you can hear the driver's footsteps.
Absolutely stunning.
Crazy.
I can hear them now.
Wow.
Oh, wow. So what's your favourite Formula One memory, Stuart?
Oh, gosh. You mean in terms of race action or being at a race? Or
being at a race action, working, anything.
Mexico 1986, my first visit to Mexico, Annie Bradshaw and I were working with sort of sister teams in the same company as it were. She was with Lotus, I was with Tyrrell. We went to Mexico, and when you drove to the race, you went past many of the ruins from the previous year's Mexico City earthquake. For the event, because we were working closely together, a chap was seconded to us, a local chap, to help us with anything we needed. You know, if you needed a paper clip, if you needed a restaurant, if you needed to get somewhere, he was always there. At the end of the race, we sort of went around and thought, well, I better get something for him, a couple of team t-shirts and so on. He said, no, I have to give you something because I'm a doctor. He was on the front line after the earthquake, but a motor racing fan all his life. And he had come to the event to say thanks to the people who were bringing life back to Mexico. And it just so happens that I have here, I'm putting to it, a little badge, checkered flag. It's got the Mexico Racing Club on it. That was given to me in 1986 by that man. So that's a favorite. Any race at Spa-Francorchamps is a favorite because it's the most spine-tingling racing circuit there has ever been. Montreal was always great. Austin, Texas in recent years was a wonderful experience, as are all the startup races that my little team has been involved in Abu Dhabi and Singapore and places like that. Those were always great. But that Mexico, I've always remembered that.
Yeah, and to be a doctor as well and volunteering his time on a motorsport event.
And who were we to know? I mean, he was obviously a cultivated, intelligent man and so on, running around at our behest for this, that, and the next thing. And said, oh, no, the doctor was the surgeon on the front line after the earthquakes.
Wow.
So that's why it was so nice to go back to Mexico recently when it was, for the third time, reanimated as a Grand Prix, and we ran the media center when it began. It's great. It's lovely to
go back. That's so cool.
That's so good.
On that and your favourite memories and all these wonderful things surrounding Formula One, to circle back to something you said earlier, you said that Mark Webber is one of your all-time greatest drivers.
One of my all-time favorite driver. A very fine driver.
Yes.
Perhaps not in the absolute upper echelon of the greatest, but an excellent driver nonetheless. But it's strange to say, like, tip-top bloke, you know, a terrific person. I have the greatest respect for him. He's a person conscious of his own limitations as well as his own excellence. And he's a person who will have an intelligent and interesting opinion on most things in the world and share it with you. And he and Anne make a fantastic partnership, and I was very privileged to be close to them for a while.
That's so wonderful to hear. And I assume in you saying that he is conscious of his own limitations, that's what makes a great racing driver though, right? Because if you go in hot-headed and aren't conscious of those limitations, how are you ever to know what you need to work on or fix or where you're being let down?
I think too, in the era of telemetry, there are no hiding places for drivers, really. And Mark was very good at accepting where he couldn't. More than once, he said to me when we were talking about a particular race, or Vettel, for example, was doing damage, and said, I knew I couldn't get to that, but he could get damn close. And many times, of course, he was faster. He took poles and won, took and fastest laps and things. So he was very clear-headed about his abilities. There was no false modesty about it, but nor was he arrogant in any way about what he's not. I really enjoyed spending time with him.
I can see that translated to Oscar Piastri now, who Mark obviously manages and mentors, in that, you know, Oscar has come out and said publicly that after his first season in Formula One, that he needs to work on, the pace is there, but he needs to work on time management.
And how lucky is he to have Mark and Anne Webber at his shoulder, yes. You know? It's great for them to have yes. him in the stable, but he will derive great benefit from Mark's and Anne's experience. Yeah, he's a lucky boy. But also, he's supremely talented, but he's got an old head on young shoulders, hasn't he? Haven't
he? Yeah.
He's amazing.
I love that about him. Monique and I both agree that Oscar Piastri is 100% world championship material, particularly McLaren with its pace it's showing at the moment. Stuart, when do you think Oscar might take his first world championship?
Well, I'm very Scottish and very careful about getting ahead of myself. I hope he will. I think he has got the makings of a world champion. I think there are people, not least of all his own teammate, that he has to climb over to get there, because Norris is obviously very gifted as well. But we'd cut him some slack and say it'll take, I think it would take 2 to 3 years for him to become champion. And he's still only such a young man, you know.
That's where he's very lucky. He does have someone kind of saying, whoa, now, Nelly, just keep your head on yourself. It's, you know, whereas, you know, challenging for it. So, yeah, I think Oscar's lucky that he's got that, yeah, level-headedness behind him.
Oh, I think so. Not only has he got his own input from people like Mark and himself and his family, but he's also spent the season alongside Lando and seen what he went through. But he's also spent, like, a couple of seasons racing some Verstappen Esquire, who's pretty hard to beat. So we know that Red Bull are not going to go away anytime soon. And a lot of people will be hoping that the iconic Ferrari will come good through Leclerc and Hamilton, which will be just as interesting to see at the other end of the spectrum.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, Oscar, really, to go back to what you said, clearly world champion potential here.
Yeah.
Love Fantastic. To hear it.
Love it. We're going to move into the final three questions now, Stuart. These are the questions we ask all of our guests that come onto the podcast. So the first question is, if you could travel for a holiday to any Formula One destination, whether it's race week or not, a current race on the calendar or a former race on the calendar, which holiday destination would you choose and why?
Well, I gave this one a lot of thought, promise you. The United States was close because Austin was wonderful, and there have been so many other race destinations in the United States, Indianapolis, where we worked as well, and the Switch Great. Lots of other places. I thought about Spa, but then what would you do in Belgium during the year? But I came up with something that will surprise most people, especially the younger generation who will never have heard of it. There's a circuit in France at a city called Clermont-Ferrand, which is in central southern France, in a district called the Auvergne. So one, if I went there, I'd have the chance to roam around the Auvergne for a few days while I was going back and forward to the circuit. Two, the circuit was phenomenal. It was 8 kilometers long. It was up and down because it's volcanic country. So it went up and down and round all these volcanic places in hardly a straight worthy of the name. And the drivers, some of the drivers used to wear open-faced helmets so that they could throw up and not choke themselves to death as we were going up, down, and all the G-forces and things.
Oh, whoa.
Wow.
Ugly. Clermont-Ferrand is a place from which came a French author who caused me nightmares when I was at uni. So I'd be able to go and either kick his gravestone or something there, and that's what you get for that. And a lot of people have just said to me how wonderful a circuit it was. It was only used 4 times for F1, but it's in a great place. It's now called the Circuit Louis Rosier, because Louis Rosier was a local driver who helped design the track. And Jackie Stewart, the aforementioned Jackie Stewart, spoke of Clermont-Ferrand with shock and awe. So that's good enough for me. I'd like to go there.
Wow.
Yeah, would you try drive it?
I don't think there's enough of it left now that you can or you're allowed to. You know, I'd love to go around it, yeah.
So the second question in our final three, if you could holiday with any Formula One driver, dead or alive, who would you choose to holiday with and why?
I gave this one a lot of thought too. I thought of people like Gilles Villeneuve, who was just such a daredevil, let's grab life by the cojones and live it sort of character. I thought of Gerhard Berger, who was very funny. And so I've coming back to a name we've just been talking about, I've thought Mark Webber. It's been great to spend time with him, relax, just talk about this, that, and the next thing, racing and the people in it and life and the people in it. So I'm plump for Mark Webber.
Mark Webber, nice one.
He's got a bit of a sense of humour too, from what I've seen. So, you know, you'd have a bit of fun with him too.
Absolutely, yeah.
Fabulous company. All right. And our final question is, if you could choose to cook a dish from any of the destinations that the Formula One currently goes to or has formerly been to, what would you choose and why?
Again, lots of thought. And again, like Annie Bradshaw, I thought about America because I love chicken wings and all that sort of stuff. Thought about Mexico, but I've come back to France and I would cook a meal of stew, which is boiled eggs, hard-boiled egg on a bed of lettuce and mayonnaise as the starter. Then I'd make coq au vin, chicken and red wine as my middle course.
Yes.
And finish with a plate of cheese and then a dessert of creme brulee. Gastronomic, right?
Oh, I'm hungry.
Oh, absolutely. Bloody fabulous. It's so nice to hear someone put so much thought into that question too, because you've given us a full four-course meal there. So, love it.
Oh, and if you only want one, I would still be French. It would be what they call steak frites, which is a steak with French fries and a little bit of green salad. That's what. If it were only one dish, that would be it every time.
Fabulous. No. Oh, wonderful choice.
Fantastic. I just also wanted to ask before we sign off quickly is, Stuart, what are you doing now? You're still working a little bit from home. Like, what are you doing at the moment?
I still follow the F1 season because I still work for Singapore and Mexico. One thing that COVID taught us is that, you know, you can do work by remote control if you've got a previous background of knowledge. So whenever I took my team, Bradshaw, Van Leeuwen, Laura, whoever it was with me, I was always the person responsible for the trackside editorial. So I sat in an office, a couple of screens, and my laptop or desktop computer and a telephone, and never really spent a lot of time out and about on the circuit. So I didn't have to be there as long as the television was working. So Singapore kindly asked me, and I do all the F1 track written reporting for them over race weekend, and the same for Mexico.
Fantastic.
Otherwise, if anybody asks me to help with a project, I will. If anybody wants a book written, you know who I am.
Please, yeah. If anyone needs their sporting autobiography written.
Well, shall we sign off?
Is that you happy with that? You sure?
Oh, my gosh.
My God, more than happy. You're incredible. Stuart, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Such interesting stories. And, oh, my God, we could sit here and talk to you for days. In fact, we might have to get you back on. There's a lot more there that we haven't even scratched the surface, I'm sure of it.
And can I suggest an Annie and Stuart special?
Ooh. Yeah, now you're talking.
Oh, God.
I reckon we'd...
Stuff would come out. Oh, we'd have to have a glass of wine beforehand or something. Stuff would come out there that cuddle your hair.
Yeah, you might have to do that one in person, definitely with a few bottles of some Pinot.
No, well, thank you very much for having.
Thank you so much for listening, guys. If you liked our podcast, you can leave us a rating or a review on your favorite podcast listening app. You can also continue the conversation by emailing us at andawaywego@f1podcast@gmail.com. If you so please, we're also on all the social media apps. So you can find us on Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, TikTok, and YouTube. Just search for And Away We Go F1 Podcast and you'll find us there.
Thank you, Stuart. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you, Monique. And thank you for having us in your ears. Until next week and until lights out.
It's lights out. Away we go!
And Away We Go podcast is produced by Diane Bortoletto and Monique Ciccato. Let's do it.